All right, so look at Song of Solomon tonight, starting in, we're going to look at chapter 1. Just kind of a disclaimer as we get into this, try to keep this as PG as possible. This teaching, there's a lot of very in-depth teachings on this book, and so I've entitled this message, Intimacy Ignited, because it's really speaking of the intimate relationship of a husband and a wife in this book. And I've also borrowed that title from a book by that same name on Christian marriage. So if you're more interested in all the in-depth of it, then I would suggest that book to you. It's again called Intimacy Ignited, and I've been reading that and borrowing some things from it. And it relates to kind of physical intimacy for married Christians, and it's a real good book. I haven't read it all, so I can't, say my stamp of approval on everything that it says, but it's an interesting thing. Now, one thing I want to kind of touch on a little bit is it's become very popular in Christian churches to focus on this issue. Some churches focusing on this for long periods of time, and it's drawn a lot of interest on news and everything publicly. And I just want you to know, I'm not joining any bandwagon. This is just where we are in the Scriptures. We are just moving on through. And so this is what we're going to talk about today. And again, because of the subject matter, the physical intimacy in marriage that's in this book, I won't be making eye contact with anyone during this whole teaching. Now, but you know, it's an interesting view on this. We're just going to really skim the surface. Because it's very, the language that's used, a child can read it and really have no idea what's going on. But a married couple can read it and understand exactly what's going on. And so there's those levels in there. You know, it's been well said of, you know, you've been out of the Bible too long when you catch your kids reading Song of Solomon and you say, where are you kids getting this stuff? You know? So there's a lot of interesting things in here. But really, when we read this book, we have to decide for ourselves, which of two interpretations are we going to take from it? There's an allegorical interpretation. In other words, many throughout history have seen it either as during the Old Testament times that it was, you know, God's love for his people. Or in New Testament times, and many godly believers even today see it as Christ's love and, you know, toward the church. And I can agree to disagree with that, but I honestly really don't see that. If that's in here at all, it's really on a secondary level. Is my good buddy Damian Kyle. He's not really my good buddy, but I listen to him all the time. As he said, when you read this book, you've got everything but Barry White singing in the background. You know, and that's what he said. And so that is the literal interpretation, that it has to do with a husband and a wife. Now, as I was reading that book, Intimacy Ignited, and believe me, I don't get any money off of the sales of it, even though I've mentioned it many times already. They talk about in there just different views toward physical intimacy in marriage for Christians. Because for really starting early on, there are some quotes from 200 AD. Already they were putting all these rules and regulations on physical intimacy within marriage. It was almost like the sexual act was something that was they were kind of embarrassed about. And so there was to be no physical intimacy on Thursdays because that's when Christ was arrested, none on Fridays because that's when Christ was crucified, none on Saturdays in honor of the Virgin Mary, none on Sundays because that's when Jesus rose from the dead. And then when you added the feast and all these things, there were 44 days out of the year that were approved for physical intimacy within marriage. And you thought, wow, that's pretty narrow. You know, but this has happened throughout time. And so we have to ask ourselves as we get into this book, and I believe that this book is a part of inspired Scripture, then either we have to have kind of really, I feel, a fanciful interpretation of saying it's God and the church, or Jesus Christ and the church, or we have to just kind of take it pretty much at face value and say, this is what it's talking about, and maybe God is okay with this within the context of marriage, and I believe that He is. So, you know, the allegorical view thinks that Solomon represents Christ and the Shulamite, or really it speaks of in the Hebrew, Mrs. Solomon, that represents the church. And again, I disagree with that. The literal interpretation believes that this is using poetic literature to describe marriage and the physical intimacy of Solomon and the Shulamite. Now, again, the Shulamite is Mrs. Solomon. I'm taking the liberty of using the name Tirzah for her, and I'll tell you why that is in just a minute. But the thing about this is we have to ask ourselves, well, I know a little bit about Solomon. And should I be taking marriage advice from Solomon? You know, a guy with 300 wives and 700 concubines, and what in the world? We have to realize Solomon wasn't always a fool. Okay, there was a time early on when he asked for wisdom and God gave him great wisdom. And so I happen to take the view that this is Solomon with his first wife before he totally went off the deep end. And we've known people who at one time were wise and who totally lost it. And so I believe that this is before Solomon went over the deep end. And it says that when he was older, he multiplied all these wives and that they turned his heart away from the Lord. So as we get into Song of Solomon, we're just going to look at chapter 1 tonight. And I want to start off with verse 1. Imagine that. We read, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." The Song of Song, which is Solomon's. So just interpreting it, that this is kind of like a great song, the Song of Songs. You know, we talk about someone being the King of Kings. He's the greatest of kings. That this is a great literature from Solomon's mouth. And I want to address a couple of things before we get into this first chapter. And one of them is Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. I'm going to read it for you. Hebrews 13, 4 says this: "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge." So marriage is an honorable thing. Marriage is a good thing. Marriage is something that God has created. And it also talks about, by the reference to the bed being undefiled, that within the marriage covenant, the physical relationship is a good thing. And then the distinction is drawn by the writer of the Hebrews, who many believe to be Paul, that fornicators or adulterers, those who have a sexual relationship outside of marriage, God's going to judge those. So that there is a place for it, and there's a place not for it. It's like set of a fire. A fire is a great thing in the fireplace. If you have a nice fire going on a cold winter's day, you know, that's, you could snuggle up next to that. That's a beautiful thing. But if you get some, you know, you get your, whatever those things are. I lived in South Texas my whole life. I don't know what it's called, the thing to grab the log, you know. You get to grab the log and you throw it out in the middle of your living room. That's a bad thing. Because the fire has lost its context. It's not where it's supposed to be. So it is for the physical relationship. It's like that fire in the fireplace. It's a beautiful thing that warms a home in that place. But if you take it out of that place, they can burn your house down. And so we have to think about that and realize that. Now, physical intimacy, another thing to realize within marriage, must be based on the principle of mutual submission. Mutual submission. So I'm going to turn one place. I think it's the only place I'm going to have you turn tonight. But to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And Paul talks about this fact. Now he writes to the church in Corinth, and we know them. Maybe you don't, but I badmouth them somewhat. They're a selfish church. And so Paul gives some instruction on marriage and of the physical relationship within marriage in this context of mutual submission to one another. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Paul writes, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Okay, well, I just thought it says in Hebrews that marriage is honorable among all. How do we put those together? Well, Paul is coming from the viewpoint of, you know what? I can serve the Lord most fully if I'm just a single guy. And that's absolutely true. If you don't have a wife and you don't have a family, then you are free to serve the Lord more wholeheartedly. That's absolutely true. So that's what he's saying. He says, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." As we're going to get into this, we're going to realize not everyone has the gift of singleness. Not everyone has that. It's a gifting of singleness. And so when the church throughout time has tried to impose singleness on people who don't have that gift, immorality has resulted. And so he's saying, you know, okay, so it's okay to get married so that you won't become sexually immoral. He says, "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due to her." Now, I wouldn't suggest using that language with your wife. Or, "Come over here, wife, let me render to you the affection due you." You know, you might want to kind of phrase it a little more like Solomon does. And likewise, also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. "Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." And I say this, but I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. "For I wish that all men were even as I myself." Here it is. "But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." Okay, so what Paul is saying is he's basically saying that in the physical intimacy relationship in marriage, that a husband and wife are to serve one another in that area. It's a mutual submission. There's not one demanding something, another demanding something. It's of serving one another. That's what it speaks of here. And Paul also says, you know, I wish everyone was like me. I wish everyone had the gift of singleness so that you can go off and serve the Lord. And that was Paul's heart. But he says there in verse 7, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. So I believe that singleness is a gift, and I also believe that marriage is a gift. And so, because if everybody had the gift of singleness, no more people. It would be all over a long time ago. So this is important that as we look at the Song of Solomon, as we look at physical intimacy within marriage, that it's always that mutual submission. Okay? It's not one partner demanding something of the other. All right, so back to Song of Solomon. Let's get into verse 2 now. We'll start off with the Shulamite, or Mrs. Solomon, or I'm going to call her Tirzah. And the reason why is if you'll look at Song of Solomon chapter 6, verse 4, he says to her, "Oh my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah." So it's a beautiful city there in Israel. And so we're just going to call her, or I'm going to call her Tirzah instead, so I don't have to always call her the Shulamite. The Shulamite, that's kind of sad. One of my best friends in high school started dating this girl, and he wouldn't ever call her by name. He called her the girl. He always called her the girl, and then he ended up getting married to the girl and having 3 kids with the girl, but he always called her the girl. Hopefully he didn't call her that at home. That would be wrong. But I don't want to call her the Shulamite, so we'll call her Tirzah. And she starts off here in verse 2, but there's so much things to say. One more thing to realize in this, like much literature, it's not, or much poetic literature, it's not in chronological order. Okay? So there's things going on here. And then later on, it's going to talk about their wedding and different things. So it's kind of, it's not in chronological order. We would like things to be that way, or maybe you don't. I would like things to be that way, but it's not here. So we start off and we see Tirzah saying, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." Pretty straightforward. Yeah, it doesn't need a lot of explanation there. But what she's saying is I don't want some peck on the cheek. You know, not something like that. This could literally be translated, "Oh, that he'd give me some of his smacking kisses that take my breath away." All righty then, okay? So she's saying these things, and it's an interesting thing to realize that she's desiring this relationship with her husband, Solomon, and that there's a tendency within marriage to kind of, you know, what might have been a passionate kisses at the beginning can kind of become the pecks on the cheek over time. And so she's calling on him to do this. Now, it's been said that a kiss can be a comma, a question mark, or an exclamation point. Okay, think about that for a minute. Okay, it could be, I could see that. It could be a comma, a question mark, or an exclamation point. And we know that from here, she's definitely looking for some exclamation points. Okay, that's what she's talking about here. Now, the application to take from what she says in verse 2 is, it's okay to be forward in the marital relationship. Within the context of marriage, it's okay to be forward. I love Genesis chapter 2, verse 25. It says, "And they were both naked, Adam and Eve." It says, "The man and his wife, and they were not ashamed." It's okay. It's okay. And so we have to realize that all these things, and we think about that, is this sometimes, especially during the Victorian era or different times, people can kind of be a little bit embarrassed of God. "Oh, God made people and he made them naked. Oh, I can't believe that, you know. Where is God's propriety? You know, she needs to have some dress covering the ankles and everything like that and covering the neck." And obviously in our culture, perhaps, well, I won't say perhaps, we've gone too far the other way. But you know what? Within the context of marriage, there should be that naked and unashamed. That's part of the marriage relationship. And we have to realize also when it comes down to physical intimacy, this may be embarrassing for us. But God made the human bodies, and God made them to work as they do, and it wasn't some accident. It wasn't like God said, "What did I do? I can't look at what those married people are doing. I can't believe it." And so sometimes we don't stop and think, "Well, that's right. God didn't make that." And realize, okay, there is a place for that. Again, the fire in the fireplace. She continues on and she says, "For your love is better than wine." Your love is better than wine. Wine, throughout the scriptures, it's symbolic of rejoicing. They had wine at the feasting. Remember Jesus' first miracle? Another could be an embarrassment to us. Jesus' first miracle, making water into wine. I can't believe that. And so he's there at the marriage feast, and they're at the wedding at Cana, and the wedding was like the premier exciting event in that culture. And in many cultures even today. And so he makes this wine, this great wine there at the end of the feast. And so it's a symbol of rejoicing, it's a symbol of feasting, it's a symbol of pleasure and of celebration. It's okay. Within a context. Now, also we know about wine is that it does have an intoxicating effect. And so when she's putting all these pieces together, she's speaking of that the love that she shares with Solomon, it's rejoicing and it's feasting and it's pleasure and it's a celebration as intoxicating effect. And then we might say to ourselves, well, great, you've already lost me because that's not how things work in the real world. And then I would ask, if we see something in the scriptures and it's not working in our lives that way, then something's wrong. Why can't it be like that? Why not? Why not? And so we have to search our own hearts and say, well, is there some reason that I'm not treating my spouse and I'm not serving my spouse or doing whatever, that this can't come alive? I remember, his name escapes me right now, but he and his wife used to do marriage seminars. And whenever at the marriage seminar, he'd always have the same line. He said, you see how beautiful my wife is? He said, I made her this way. And then everybody's like, what are you talking about? But he was talking about how he treated his wife. The way he treated his wife and loved his wife, and she glowed because of how he treated her. And so we have to consider that. All right, verse 3. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth, therefore the virgins love you. All right, the fragrance of your good ointments. So Solomon was a good-smelling man. That's what he's talking about. So Solomon didn't come in, you know, for a hard day of doing whatever and just kind of plop his feet up on there and he's just stinking. You know, remember Pigpen from the Charlie Brown? He's kind of got that dust going all everywhere he goes. That wasn't Solomon. Solomon was considerate. And so the application, especially for men, deodorant and cologne are good things. And now it's a good thing to have in the medicine cabinet. I walked into the student center yesterday afternoon. Tuesday's my lockup day at school. And I walked into the student center. I was like, wow, it smells like high school boys in here. Oh, man, it just was not a good smell in there. And it's just a reminder, yeah, deodorant and cologne. Yeah, we need to have that talk with these boys because it is a good thing. And so that's what she's recognizing that. Okay, he smells good. But it's not only about his physical smells. She says, your name is ointment poured forth. Solomon, at this time, was still a man of character. He was still a man of good reputation. And so Tirzah compliments him on this truth. A couple things to realize from that is, number one, is it's not just about physical appearance. It's not just about smelling good. It's about, especially for husbands or for wives, are we people of character that our spouse can respect? Are we people that our spouse can respect? Or does our spouse say, well, he's lazy and he's this and he's that, and I really, don't feel close to him in a physical way because he's just a complete mess. And so there's not only working on the outside, it's obviously working on the inside to present yourself in such a way that your spouse can respect you. Now also, Tirzah, what she does is she compliments Solomon on this truth. And so the question for us is, do we compliment our spouse's character? You know, we can compliment our spouse about, you look nice in that dress, or your hair looks good, or this kind of things. But what about something else besides that? You know, I probably shared from the pulpit before, at our school, whenever you say something mean or a student says something mean to another person, they have to say three nice things. But only one can be about appearance. Only one about appearance. And then two have to be something about that person, something about the character of that person. And so it is for us. Maybe that's something good for us to do with our spouse. Maybe you want to say one nice thing about their appearance, but a couple good things about their character. Maybe they're about their faithfulness or their patience or their strong work ethic or their compassion. Looking for things to compliment your spouse about, and maybe that's going to build up that relationship. And so she continues on there in verse 3 and says, therefore the virgins love you. Speaking of the women there, you know, the young maidens, I think that she's basically saying, Solomon, you're a dreamboat. You know, I'm dating myself for using that, you know, but Solomon apparently was a good-looking guy and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, all the young girls would be like, oh, someone like Solomon, you know, kind of attitude. And she's complimenting him on that. Now, one thing that's confusing as we get into this, especially in the New King James Version, starting in verse 4, we have kind of all these little subheadings of who is speaking, but those are really debatable. It's kind of debatable on who is speaking where. So at times, I'm going to kind of borrow from the NASB, because I think that I agree with their interpretation more. In the NASB, it has, for this next couple of verses, or the first part, I'm sorry, of verse 4, that it's all still terse of speaking. So they translate it this way, quote, draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. So the NASB translate this as this is still terse of talking, not the daughters of Jerusalem. Now who these daughters of Jerusalem are, this is just kind of like an imaginary chorus, kind of joining into this, because keep in mind Solomon is writing this whole thing. So it's about Solomon and it's about his wife, and then he kind of has these daughters of Jerusalem kind of as a poetic use to bring another voice into the whole thing. So I believe that she is saying this. She's calling on Solomon to draw her away and let us run together and to bring me into his chambers. So Tirzah and Solomon here are off to a romantic rendezvous. There within the context of their marriage. And I think the application for us as in a busy world that we live in is to make time to get away with your spouse. Make time to get away. Take a little trip. Take a little trip. No, that's not a good song. And so these things that I waste my synapses on. But it's a good thing to think, you know what? We need to go away for a weekend. Or we need to go away for a day. Or we need to do something to get out of this routine. And that's a good application to take from this. Now, the daughters of Jerusalem here, or the chorus, as I've already spoken of, in the NASB, it says that they say, we will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. And so it kind of has the chorus speaking and proclaiming a blessing or approval on Tirzah and Solomon's relationship. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. And I think that we know this in our hearts. When we go to weddings, hopefully we're not wearing black. You know, unless you're, you know, you're in the wedding party, you know, you're not there like, oh, great, another people getting married. And just, wow, that's a bummer. We recognize that a wedding is a time of rejoicing. It's a time of blessing. Two people in relationship, and that's awesome. Hopefully we won't be throwing cold water on them, you know, and saying, well, you have fun today, but it's going to really stink later on. That's not the attitude that we're to have. And so this chorus that comes in is really pronouncing their blessing and approval on Tirzah and Solomon's relationship. It's good that they have physical intimacy within their marriage. And so, again, physical intimacy within marriage is to be celebrated. It's a celebrated thing. And don't forget that the Creator God created human bodies and he created marriage, so you do the math. All right? He knows what he's doing, and it's a good thing. Now, Tirzah is speaking here in verse 5. She says, I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. So I was joking with Brandy when I was putting together this study that instead of calling her Tirzah, I was going to call her dark and lovely. You know, but, you know, that sounds like chocolate. But here she is, and she's talking about the color of her skin. So apparently Tirzah was a dark-skinned woman with dark hair. And we're going to see in just a couple of, or next verse or so, that she's kind of self-conscious about that. So that's just the fact. That's how she looked. And then she says in verse 6, do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me the keeper of the vineyards. But my own vineyard I have not kept. So apparently Tirzah was self-conscious about how dark her skin was. She was self-conscious about it. The NLT translates it this way, quote, don't look down on me, you fair city girls, just because my complexion is so dark. So it's interesting, taking a little liberty, you know, with the translation. But you can think about it, that if there were these maybe these fair maidens, maybe these women there in Jerusalem who maybe even younger girls and who are not of marrying age yet. But a lot of times younger girls, that they're just kind of going around causing trouble, being busybodies. And maybe they've never had to work a day in their life. And they're all light-skinned because they've never had to be in the sun. And then here comes this woman, this bride of Solomon. And it says here in verse 6 that she's actually had to work. That she's had older brothers that made her work out in the vineyard. And so she's been exposed to the sun. And she's self-conscious about it because she looks different. There's some speculation that she's from Lebanon originally. So maybe she's also a foreigner. And so she's feeling all these different things. And I think that the application for us is that spouses, especially husbands, need to be aware of the insecurities of the person they're married to. Need to realize the things that bother your spouse and to make an effort never to pile on. Make an effort never to, you know, well, I know my wife is insecure about this or my husband's insecure about this and they really made me mad, so I'm going to stick the dagger in. But to realize that, hey, this is a sensitive area for that person, whether it's a real thing or it's imagined. And you know what? I'm going to make sure that I don't make them feel any more insecure in that area. I'm going to do whatever I can to bless them and to kind of alleviate that pain that they may have. And so Tirzah now speaks to Solomon in verse 7. She says, "Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils yourself by the flocks of your companions?" Now, so Solomon is king. He was the shepherd of Israel. He was the shepherd of Israel. He was the one who was to lead the sheep, to shepherd the people. And I don't think it's an accident that God chose David, who was a shepherd, to kind of really bring that symbolism home. Saul was not that type of guy. Saul was a guy who was all about himself. But David was a guy who was used to protecting people who are protecting things, those sheep, who couldn't protect themselves. And so by calling Solomon the shepherd here, or saying, you know, where's your flock and all this, I really think she's talking about him being the shepherd of Israel. Now, what she's saying here in verse 7 is really a veiled invitation to physical intimacy. And it's what we see throughout this book. And so we just kind of have to get used to it or pretend that it doesn't exist. But she's using code words to speak about this. And so I'll let you know, your imagination run wild on your own, exactly what she's talking about here. But the fact that she's using code words, I think, again, applies to marriage. Because physical intimacy within marriage is only for the husband and wife. It's something that the husband and wife share alone. That it's all about them. And so, you know what, it's okay to have that code language that no one else understands. That's something that's between the husband and wife. You know why? Because it adds to the fun of it and it adds to the exclusivity of it. There's something that we have. There's a language we have. There's something that we refer to that no one else knows about. And it's just me and my wife. And so I think that's important. And I think I have it somewhere else in my notes here. But I'm going to go ahead and say it here. I believe wholeheartedly that spouses should be best friends. I don't believe that there ever should be a friend that is closer than your spouse. I don't believe it. So, you know, I like to have guys that are friends, but I'm not looking for a best friend ever because Brandy is my best friend and there's no one that should come within that. And so this kind of adds to that. When you have this code language and you have these fun things that you say that no one else knows about, then that adds to that closeness. Remember what Jesus said? Jesus said, "I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends because I tell you what I'm doing." And so it is, when you share things with that person who's your best friend, your spouse, then that creates a bond to it. And so I just want to warn against the danger of ever finding a best friend that's not your spouse. I just want to lay that out there. I think that's big, big trouble. Verse 8, Solomon responds to Tirzah. She says, "If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents." And so she's saying basically, hey, where are you going to be? And I don't want to have to go walking around with the veil because, you know, that a veiled person at times could be a prostitute. We see that from earlier on with Judah's whole episode. And so he is kind of responding to her invitation with a little code words of his own. And it's interesting, though, because he's putting her insecurities to rest. Remember early on, just a few verses earlier, she's kind of complaining about how dark she is. And so what he says here, when he responds to her invitation, he says to her, "O fairest among women." And I like, how the NASB translates it. Translates it, "O most beautiful among women." So he's not saying, "Oh, well, you're pretty dark, you know, but not too dark." He's not doing that. He's calling her, "O fairest among women," or "most beautiful among women." He's sweeping what she has away, and he's dealing with her insecurity, and he's calling her most beautiful among women. And I think, again, this is the importance of complimenting a spouse. And we often think of the husband complimenting the wife, and I think that's important. But it's also important for the wife to compliment the husband. And for the purpose of edification. Purpose of edification, building the other one up. Don't compliment your spouse because you're about to reel off 15 things they did wrong. Okay? You want to compliment your spouse and then just leave it out there. And you know, your spouse may be waiting, "Well, they're going to hammer me now. Complimented me." And then the hammering never comes. "Hey, that was kind of nice. You know, I feel edified now." And so we want to make sure to compliment our spouse, especially in those areas of insecurity. I love what Paul says, and I'll just read it for you. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 28, he says, "Husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." Very true, Paul, very true. That when a husband loves and cares for his wife, he's loving himself. Why? Because happy wife, happy life. When you take good care of your wife, you just make things better off for yourself as a husband. And so Solomon understands that. So Solomon responds in the affirmative to her invitation for intimacy. Verse 9, and he says, "I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots." Well, you know, up in the Northeast, they may think that that's an insult, but we as Texans can appreciate a good wife-to-horse comparison. You know, I mean, that's okay. That's okay. So, but some have seen that and said, "What in the world is Solomon talking about? You know, he had it going okay, but then compares his wife to a horse?" But as we look at the context of Scripture, and horses in the Scripture are always referred to, they're beautiful things. They're fearsome things. They're powerful things. No Humvees back in the day. No tanks or anything. I mean, a horse was the pinnacle of military superiority. If you had horses and chariots, you have power. And these horses, they're muscular and they're fluid and they're beautiful and they're graceful and they're powerful. And these are awesome things. So by him comparing her to a filly among Pharaoh's chariots, he didn't get a slap in the face or anything. He's calling her a beautiful and graceful and powerful creation. So it's a good thing. Now, I'm not saying that it would necessarily work if you use this, but, you know, you can try. But I warned you. And he calls her also my love. He says, "I have compared you, my love." It could be translated, "my darling." My darling. Now, some of the words for love and desire here throughout the book of Song of Solomon refer especially to physical intimacy, but not this word love. This word love, that could also be translated, as I said, "my darling," it refers to the idea of friendship or companionship. And so what Solomon is conveying here to Tirzah is that he's not only interested in her because of a physical relationship, but she's his companion. She's his darling. She's his friend. And so, as I've said before, I'm a firm believer that your spouse should be your best friend. No ifs, ands, or buts. You're not going to win an argument with me about saying, "Well, you know what, I have this other best friend, and my spouse is one step below." That ain't going to work. It's not going to work. Now, again, if you ever find yourself in that situation, that you have a best friend that is not your spouse, you got to change it. Change the situation. Things have got to change immediately. Now, we have verses 10 and 11. I believe that these are all spoken by Solomon. I know it has the daughters of Jerusalem there for verse 11, but I'm under the impression that verses 10 and 11 are both spoken by Solomon. So, we read here, "Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments. your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver." So Solomon's complimenting her jewelry, complimenting her dress, and he promises even finer jewelry that's going to be made for her. "You think you look good now, you know, but we're going to make you even something more, something better." So again, two things to take away from these two verses. Number one, again, and you've probably heard this a few times, compliment your spouse. Compliment your spouse. And I don't want to hear from anyone, "Well, I just don't compliment people. You know, that's not who I am. That's not..." Change. Change. Yeah, if you say, "Well, I'm not a person who compliments other people," change. Don't compliment. You don't have to compliment anyone else. Don't compliment me. Compliment your spouse. That's what Solomon does. And the second thing we can learn from these verses is it's okay to buy your spouse something every once in a while. It's okay. And you say, "Well, I'm horrible at picking anything out." Well, take them with you, okay? And give them permission to buy something that's for them every once in a while. That's okay. It's a good thing. You know, that's it's a good investment if it's going to help your marriage. It's okay thing. And so he says, we're going to make you even better jewelry. Verse 12. This is Tirzah speaking again. She says, "While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance." So as Tirzah and Solomon are eating dinner together, the fragrance of spikenard with which she has anointed herself fills the room. So Solomon's not only he's not the only good smelling person, but Tirzah has anointed herself with spikenard. She's anointed herself with this fragrant oil. We remember also Jesus. Remember when he was anointed with spikenard by Mary, the sister of Lazarus. And so she's smelling good here as they eat together. And the application is that guys aren't the only ones who should try to smell good. You know, it's fair game. They make good smelling products for men and for women. And so it's an okay thing. But also behind all of this is Tirzah wishes to be pleasing to Solomon. That's the idea. That she's not going to say, "Well, you know what, you're the man and I'm the woman and you should be thankful that you have me for your wife. So you need to do your thing and I'm just going to show up." That's not her attitude. It's, again, it's that mutual submission. And when you have a marriage, when both couples wish to please each other, when you have a marriage where both individuals wish to please each other, wish to serve each other, then you have a strong marriage. Always marriages are weak when there's one person who's rowing and the other person isn't. Think about that. Think about marriage like a rowboat. And I don't know if you've ever been on a rowboat where there's been having to be two rowers, but it takes a little while to get used to it. Because you have to get everything just right. Because if one is rowing stronger than the other, they end up just going in circles. Never get anywhere. It's not a whole lot of fun. And so in a marriage, if both are rowing equally, you're going to get somewhere. You're going to get to where you're going. And so it's important for each person to do their part. It's especially easy for me to go through a book like this and to always pick on husbands. Because husbands are easy prey. And because I am one. And I know all the idiotic things that I do. And so, but it's important that we realize that a marriage is not only made up of a husband. It's made up of a husband and a wife. And so as each are rowing together, you're going to get somewhere. All right, verse 13. It says, "A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts." Can't believe that that's written in the Bible. I'll tell you what. This refers to an ancient Near East custom of wearing a sack of myrrh around the neck. That a person would wear this, especially a woman would wear this at night, and it would fill the room with fragrance, and then the room would be filled with fragrance the next day. But it also speaks of Tirzah's desire for Solomon to be close to her in physical proximity. Again, you know, I don't need to draw this all out for you. You can understand what she's talking about here in this situation. So she's talking about being close to him in physical intimacy. Then in verse 14, she says, "My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." Now, that's pretty good stuff there, you know. Henna blooms, you know, this flower. And so what is this En-Gedi, though? En-Gedi is an area in Israel. Now, if you've ever been to Israel, you've seen pictures of Israel, you've seen movies of Israel, Israel's a pretty dry and rocky place. There's an old fable that there were two angels assigned to put all the rocks out in the whole world. And one did his job, and the other just dropped all his rocks in Israel. And so that's kind of how it seems at times. But En-Gedi is interesting. And Gedi is actually a place that's this lush oasis. In the midst of all this rocky and dry land, there's this lush oasis. And there's actually waterfall and springs of water. There's tropical plants. There's all these birds and exotic plants and amazing stuff. I was reading about it and I was like, man, I want to go here. That's a neat place. It's this oasis area in the midst of a desert. And what she is saying to Solomon is that you're my oasis. You're my oasis in the midst of all this. You're this place that's different from everything else. And wow, that you know, Solomon was like, wow, that sounds pretty good. You know, kind of puff his chest out a little bit. But what a neat thing for a wife to be able to compliment her husband in that way and to use such vivid language. So it's a really beautiful thing. And then Solomon responds to Tirzah in verse 15. He says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." Dove's eyes. I got plenty of doves in my backyard and I'm tired of them. You know, there's doves everywhere. What is he saying? Well, when he's talking about the dove's eyes, he's talking about them being soft and luminous. Okay? He's speaking of the beauty of her, that she's fair. She's my love, my darling, and you're fair, you're beautiful. You have soft and luminous and alluring eyes. So he's really pouring it on here. Now, we have to look at this and say, well, Solomon, what you flatterer you. Well, flattery is when you say something that's untrue to get something that you want, and that's not anything that we read throughout this book. We see genuine complimenting. We see genuine just being able to say this. And we might read it, and I don't know about you, but when I read this and even teach on it, it kind of feels a little bit like, wow, I'm kind of creeping in on something that I shouldn't be a part of. You know what I mean? Whoa, I'm getting a little too close to this whole situation. But it's beautiful because this is all okay, and it's not cheesy because it's within the context of a real marriage. And all that, it's okay within the context of marriage. It seems really messed up and messy and just weird if you take it out outside of the context of a real marriage. But when it's a real marriage, then this is okay. And it actually becomes a beautiful thing. All right, Tirzah responds to Solomon these last two verses, verses 16 and 17, and then we'll close for tonight. "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved, yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green, the beams of our houses are cedar, and our rafters of fir." And so Tirzah, she compliments Solomon that he is handsome. "You're a good-looking man, Solomon. Smell good, look good." And so she compliments him there. But also notice that she talks about how the coverings of her bed. She talks about how the house is made. You know, these beams of cedar and these rafters of fir, F-I-R, not F-U-R. And she's talking about this. She appreciates how the bedroom is decorated. She appreciates that, you know, and this ties in. You know, if your bedroom looks like a prison cell, it's not really conducive for the marriage. You know, that's not really going to help things out. So kind of an application right here, and this is a personal opinion. You can, again, throw it in the trash if you like. You know, you don't fight your wife on home decor. Don't fight your wife on home decor. Never thought I'd, you know, when I first wanted to become a pastor, I thought someday I want to say from the pulpit, don't fight your wife on home decor. But I think that's wisdom from the Lord. That's wisdom from the Lord. If your wife can make a beautiful house and she feels comfortable there and she feels like, okay, this is a place that's presentable and this is my bedroom and the way it is, it's a sanctuary for me, that's going to be conducive to the physical intimacy in marriage. And so there's some battles, you know, don't, you know, I've got to have a Dallas Cowboy bedroom. Don't do that, okay? Don't do that, guys. You don't want to fight your wife on this. Okay, so that's all the time we have for tonight here. But, you know, what conclusion can we draw from all of this? Well, I think there's a lot of good applications. But the theme, I think, that kept on coming up throughout really is the complimenting your spouse. You know, if you could take one thing away from this and just seek to, you know, build and strengthen your marriage through it, is just find places, find ways, find reasons to compliment your spouse. You know, that might go a long way. So, interesting things that we'll read throughout the rest of this book, and I look forward to seeing how uncomfortable it can make me. But let's close in prayer. Lord, I thank you for this time, and I thank you, Lord, for your word. And I thank you, Lord, for just all the differences that come up as we study through your word. And wow, what night and day from Ecclesiastes to this, Lord. But I do pray, Lord, pray for my marriage. And I pray for the marriages represented here. And Lord, for the marriages of those friends and family members, Lord, that we know. I pray especially for our friends and family that... for those who don't know you, Lord, that they would come to know you and be saved, and that you would transform their marriages, Lord. And I also pray, Lord, just for the relationships within marriage, that we might grow through this book and just really get practical wisdom that could improve our marriages. And we know that that would in turn improve our families and our churches. And Lord, that you would just take us where you want us to go as we study through your word. Just pray in Jesus' name. Amen.